Nuclear messaging and organizing. Those who object to and protest against nuclear in any of its many forms tend to be isolated from others who do so, because they're focused on local issues or one aspect of the nuclear industry to the exclusion of others, because let's face it, there's a lot to this topic. We often do our work solo. But then you hear about groups working to bring anti-nuclear individuals and environmental groups into coordination with each other, with our talking points, tactics, and strategies. And when it comes to communicating our concerns with legislators or others in power, it helps to hear guidance when a genuine expert in communications points out,
people are impacted across the country. And when they hear these stories of, you know, my child contracted cancer, that's not their fault. It's the fault of the U.S. military industrial complex and our love for these weapons. And these weapons aren't actually keeping us safe. They're causing deep, deep harm in our communities. And whenever we're able to tell the individual stories of people impacted, it just makes our case even stronger for abolition, for compensation to those harmed by the military-industrial complex, and nuclear weapons industrial complex, and beyond.
Well, when representatives of groups like Rethink Media and the Plowshares Fund get together to help the rest of us pull together, you start to see resistance to all things nuclear gather strength and reach and give us the ability to fight back even stronger and more efficiently against that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we hear from two organizers who have been working to coordinate anti-nuclear talking points and groups so that we coordinate our messaging and pull together in our efforts. Bonnie Fisk is Director of Development for the Plowshares Fund, and Mac Hamilton is Program Director, Peace and Security for Rethink Media. These two groups put together the screenings of Oppenheimer that included panel discussions on the issues and did strong outreach into local communities to get people involved. In light of the Hollywood strikes that took the actors and writers off the front lines, they helped position our movement against nuclear weapons as the lead group commenting on that film. How they did it is quite the story. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than we will ever hear from politicians debating on national television. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd, 2023, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting with the big story this week, Japan's seemingly unstoppable drive to release 1.3 million tons of tritium-contaminated radioactive water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, currently set to begin at 1 p.m. Japan time on Thursday, August 24th, which is the same as 10 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesday, August 23rd. Protests against this action have been mounted and continue to occur in the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, Fiji, Japan, Switzerland, Canada, Australia, Korea, and others of the Pacific Island nations. Japan announced that this was their plan in April of 2021, and nothing, not common sense, not alternative solutions, have even been considered stop or even slow down this radiological assault on the Pacific Ocean and by extension, everyone. Japan and TEPCO have claimed that there is no more space to store the water, but Google Maps clearly shows a large swath of unoccupied, radiologically contaminated land around Fukushima Daiichi that could easily have been converted to space for more storage tanks. In recent weeks, both China and Russia have suggested an evaporation process for the water that would concentrate the radionuclides and allow them to be sequestered. Japan turned that down. Others suggested plans for vitrification, putting the water into glass cubes where it could be stored long-term, have also been rejected. Considering that Japan has been on one trajectory for 2 years and 4 months with no variation from the plan speaks to the possibility that there is something underlying this decision. To use the Watergate adage, follow the money. Or maybe it's latent revenge for the country having been hit with 2 atomic bombs at the end of World War II. But whatever the reason, the time is upon us. Nothing looks like it's going to stay Japan's hand in taking this move. And we all must take steps to protect ourselves from anything, any food, sea salt, anything that has even touched the Pacific Ocean. With the caveat that the Pacific is not separate from the other oceans of the world. And once the water is contaminated, it will continue to spread. In a probably related story, Prime Minister Kishida's disapproval rating has hit 50%. To learn more about the dangers that we face, check out Nuclear Hot Seat number 613 with marine biologist Tim Deer Jones from March 22, 2023. We will also have a link up to the Friends of the Earth Japan's PDF, a Q&A about what the treated but still contaminated water at the Fukushima nuclear plant is all about. That will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 635. We'll also have a link from the Korea Center for Sustainable Development that lists all of the known international demonstrations against this radioactive water release. Here in the U.S., some better news about proposed release of radioactive water into our waterways. In New York, a measure to block discharges of radioactive water into the Hudson River as part of the Indian Point nuclear plant's decommissioning was signed into law on Friday, August 8th by New York Governor Katie Hochul. The bill was introduced to thwart the planned release of 1.3 million gallons of water contaminated with radioactive tritium from the retired plant, which is only 25 miles or 40 kilometers north of New York City. The plan sparked a groundswell of opposition in the suburban communities along the river, where many feared that the discharges would depress real estate values and drive away sailors, kayakers, and swimmers after decades of progress in cleaning up the Hudson River. And in Massachusetts, the state has scheduled a public hearing before it finalizes a decision on the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station's plan to discharge radioactive water into Cape Cod Bay. Note that the plans for both Pilgrim and Indian Point were made by decommissioning company Holtec. Residents will be allowed to speak to the panel. Among concerns that have already been voiced include unknown impacts from a level of tritium that cannot be removed from the water and whatever heavy metals that may also contain any amount of radioactive isotopes. A large contingent of fishermen are expected to be there, and the hearing is expected to be jammed with activists and concerned citizens. The Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection points out the State Ocean Sanctuaries Act prohibits the dumping of industrial waste into a designated ocean sanctuary, including Cape Cod Bay. As soon as the hearing was announced, opponents began working to coordinate their testimony. And longtime Pilgrim activist Mary Lampert said, emails have been flying. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Num Nuts of the Week.
A big honking story in the Washington Post cited cancer among younger Americans being on the rise, according to a new study. Some of the biggest increases were seen in women and in younger people diagnosed with gastrointestinal and breast cancers. The article says there is not a clear explanation as to why cancer is rising among younger people, but experts, put that in quote, say there are several possible reasons, including rising obesity rates, lifestyle factors such as drinking alcohol, smoking, sleeping poorly, and being sedentary. Environmental factors include exposure to pollutants and carcinogenic chemicals. But not once, nowhere, was the R word mentioned. Radiation. Exposure to radiation. We know from the work of Gender and Radiation Impact Project that women are twice as vulnerable to radiation as men, and children, little girls, are 10 times more vulnerable to the same amount of radiation as is set by the standard, which is according to an adult male body. So women and younger people are getting cancer more frequently? Perhaps, radiologically speaking, 1 + 1 does equal 2. And that's why Washington Post, for not lifting up the edge of the cover on radiation and taking a look at that in your story, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat Numbnuts of the Week.
As an international footnote to the numbnuts, a huge study of nuclear workers in France, the United Kingdom, and the United States confirms low-dose radiation as a cause of cancer. We will link to that story. In Saskatchewan, Federal Minister of Energy and Natural Resources Jonathan Wilkinson announced $74 million in funding for Saskatchewan to support the development of a small nuclear reactor in the province. Among the lies embedded in the announcement were that they were investing in, quote, non-emitting nuclear technologies, when tritium releases into groundwater exist in every nuclear reactor that has ever been built, and claims this move will power us forward to a future that leverages Saskatchewan's world-leading production of uranium to create cancers, birth defects, and promote environmental racism. No, he didn't say that. It's the promotion of jobs. The nightmare portion is just the bonus they don't like to talk about. No one from the Saskatchewan government or First Nations people attended this announcement last Saturday. We're working on getting a rebuttal from our Saskatchewan correspondents, Marius and Candace Paul. In France, the nuclear industry continues in hot water, literally. On Monday, French power company EDF took its 1.3 gigawatt nuclear reactor Golfech 2, located close to the southern town of Toulouse, offline, citing environmental reasons, meaning the heat wave affecting a large part of the country has warmed rivers used for cooling some of its reactors. Others expected to be taken offline because of high temperatures include Triskastin on the Rhone River and the Bouguer facility, 75 kilometers or 46 miles away from the Swiss border. All three of these reactor facilities are expected to be offline possibly until Tuesday, August 29. And in Australia, the ruling Labour Party has reaffirmed its commitment to sign and ratify the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. No timeline yet for when they will do this. Linda Pence Gunter is on a 3-month sabbatical and will be rejoining Nuclear Hot Seat with the Hot Story in November. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, nuclear weapons and fallout, reactors, uranium mining, radioactive waste, accidents, permissible radiation exposures, and now the dump of tritium-contaminated radioactive water into the Pacific by the country of Japan. The list of nuclear dangers and disasters is as endless as the risks from plutonium, which remains dangerously radioactive for 240,000 years. Yet despite the known dangers, this industry perpetuates itself, making obscene amounts of money while threatening the future of the planet and of life itself. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here, to help you keep track of what's going on in the nuclear world and, if it upsets you, what you can do about it. We are dedicated to giving you the nuclear stories you can't find in mainstream media and the stories behind those stories, providing you with context and continuity so you can understand the full picture. We cover not only what the industry is doing, but how brave activists around the world are fighting back. And how any one of us, and that includes you listening right there right now, any one of us can take action towards stopping the nuclear madness. But in order to do so, we here at Nuclear Hot Seat need your help. This show runs on donations. So to keep doing this work and reporting back to you, we need your support. We make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and that's where you can send us a one-time donation of any amount, or set up a recurring donation once a month, say $5, the same as a cup of coffee. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, which means that whatever you donate, it's tax deductible. So do it now. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red button, or if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Click pause, go to nuclearhotseat.com, donate right now, and then come back and listen to the rest of the show. Whatever you can do to help, you have my gratitude. Now here's this week's featured interview. Anti-nuclear activists are often isolated from each other because we focus on what's most important to us and most immediate. A local issue with radioactive waste, uranium mining, weapons, or a spike in health crises. Or we're working on the same issues, but not necessarily in touch with each other to coordinate what we're doing and saying to make a bigger media splash with our limited resources. Today's guests are among those making a difference in terms of how all of us work together and strategizing so that we're all on the same page. Bonnie Fisk is Director of Development for the Plowshares Fund, a public grant-making foundation that supports initiatives to prevent the spread and use of nuclear weapons and to prevent conflicts that could lead to their use. Mac Hamilton is Program Director, Peace and Security for Rethink Media, which builds capacity across movements, works to minimize competition, maximize resources, and raise the voices of underrepresented spokespeople. Together, they were involved in producing the 6 sold-out previews of the Oppenheimer film around the country, each one of which featured a panel discussion before the film on the issues raised by the film. And they gave us a huge leg up that led to news stories and features all over the place, especially on what the movie did not cover. Together, the work done by these two groups is positioned to make a huge difference in our future, and I'm honored to be speaking to these two lead women. I spoke with Bonnie and Mac on Friday, August 18, 2023. Bonnie Fisk and Mac Hamilton, thank you so much for joining me today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Pleased to be here.
Let's give a little bit of background to the organizations. Let's start with you, Bonnie. What is the Plowshares Fund, which organized the screening of Oppenheimer that I attended in Los Angeles? What's the background and the intent of the organization?
Plowshares Fund is the largest foundation singularly focused on reducing and eliminating nuclear threats. We do this through our time-tested grant-making strategy, as well as in our role as a convener. In essence, we bring our grantee partners as well as other partners in the nuclear field together to work collaboratively, which has historically maybe been a challenge for our field. We support Rethink is amongst the partners that we fund because their work to spread our collective messaging with the general public is critical to our goals. Happy to be here with Mac too.
What relationship, if any, does Plowshares, as you are expressing it, have with the organization that was behind Sister Megan Rice's 2012 break-in at the Y-12 weapons complex in Tennessee, and the more recent action in the Netherlands, where activists from the U.S., Germany, and the Netherlands, mostly Catholic workers, entered the Vokel Air Base in the Netherlands on August 8th to protest the approximately 15 U.S. nuclear bombs stockpiled there. Any connection?
No connection with Plowshares Fund. There is another organization called Plowshares, spelled a little differently. We are P-L-O-U-G-H and they are P-L-O-W. So that could be the group that was involved with that. We were not.
Mac, what is Rethink Media and what is your relationship to Plowshares?
Yes, well, so pleased to be here with you today. Thank you so much for having me. Rethink Media is an organization that works to strengthen social movements through strengthened communication strategy. So we work on a number of issues. I work in the peace and security portfolio, but we also work on protecting U.S. democracy and protecting rights and inclusion. And so we have a few different issue areas that we work on, but we work quite closely with Plowshares and have for many years. We are pleased to be funded by them in order to be kind of a backbone of the U.S.-based nuclear nonproliferation and abolition community. So really, our role is to use data-backed strategies to ensure that there's less competition between groups and that we're messaging together as much as possible in order to ensure that the movement's as strong as it can be.
What kind of actions or activities do you offer in general to groups?
A lot of different things. One of our most known resources is that we send a roundup of each day's news on nuclear issues, particularly nuclear weapons issues, to the policy and journalist community. And that's really just so that folks know how the media is talking about these issues and can respond accordingly and track them over time. So we, by looking at the news every single morning, can see how the dialogue is shifting in the U.S. media or not shifting, and then really try to apply strategies to ensure that advocates and experts are at the forefront of what's being discussed in the media. So that's one of the key things. We'll also look at what are kind of key anniversaries or key moments that we know the media is going to zoom in on in the nuclear space. So maybe it's the upcoming meeting of states parties of the TPNW, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, in New York coming up this fall. Maybe it's the anniversary of a nuclear test, for example, the 70th anniversary of the Castle Bravo test in the Marshall Islands is coming up next spring. And then how do we align the community to make sure that we're all using these media moments to uplift the messages that we think are going to lead to nonproliferation and abolition of nuclear weapons?
My big question is why I'm not on this list, how I get on it, and we will make it available to others, because I feel that from what you're saying, there's not a single group that opposes nuclear, be it weapons or reactors or the mining or any of the other issues, that cannot benefit from having this information. It's absolutely crucial to what we are doing. So both of your groups and many others are working against nuclear weapons. Yet there does not seem to be any kind of a coordinated movement or groundswell or anything in the public when it comes to opposing nuclear. Certainly nothing like what we saw in the 70s and 80s. Why do you think that is?
I think one piece of this is that when risk is high, there's more and more conversation about nuclear issues. And I imagine that that's true. I work more on nuclear weapons issues and don't work as much on nuclear energy issues. But for example, I mean, we're really coming at this from a media standpoint, but for the Fukushima disaster, obviously there's all sorts of media engagement. The public is concerned. Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the threats at the Zaporizhia power plant, Russia's nuclear threats against Ukraine, et cetera. These big media moments are what make the public afraid and what often generates action. Something that we see often in the media space is that a fear response can make people feel disempowered, particularly when it comes to U.S. foreign affairs and big issues like nuclear weapons, that people just feel like they don't have any kind of democratic say into that process. And that's a huge challenge. It's something that we try to work with advocates and experts when they're talking to media to show that there are steps that we can take. There are things that the public can do. There are things that policymakers can do in order to lower and de-escalate the threat. What I would say is that we can do a better job of harnessing those media moments, like happened, for example, throughout the Cold War at different points of escalation. People were really compelled to take action. And the message was, there is something we can do. The world does not have to be this way. And we need to kind of take our cues from the activists who came before us, who had a lot of success when it came to implementing arms control agreements, to getting the nuclear powers to lower the numbers of their arsenals. And we have those moments available to us now. We have moments of escalation with North Korea, the U.S.-China relationship, of course, with Russia, Ukraine, and the threats happening in Europe as well. And so we need to be better and more aligned when it comes to engaging in moments like that.
Bonnie?
Yeah, agree on all aspects of that. And this issue just has not been on people's minds since the 80s in general. I'll just add on to that, that I think Oppenheimer is a pop culture, rare opportunity for Plowshares Fund and our partners to spread the message about this issue. So our biggest challenge, I think, has been a lack of public understanding and knowledge about nuclear threats in general. And when we heard about plans for the film, we knew immediately that a film of this caliber would pique public interest about nuclear weapons issues in a way that we haven't seen in decades. So our field actually has chosen to take advantage of that at this point. The field also came at an opportune moment. Plowshares Fund is taking on a new and expanded supportive role to help build a healthier, more nimble, more effective nuclear field. Part of this work to help build a healthier field has included the rollout of Aligning Action, which is a partnership of organizations and individuals engaged in nuclear threat reduction and disarmament efforts. Basically, we serve as a hub where we can collectively discover how we weave our work together. It was through Aligning Action that we were able to harness the unique opportunity presented to us by Nolan's film, the release of the film, because rather than each organization working individually to respond to this crossover moment with duplicative messaging, we led the collaboration of over 24 partner organizations to organize 6 sold-out events in 6 cities. Ultimately, we were able to avoid diluting the field's overall impact, and then we were also able to share some important messaging outside of what was covered by the film. Now, Aligning Action isn't just limited to what happened with the Oppenheimer film. There are other initiatives that are underway right now, but that was definitely an opportunity for us to put our theories and our new supportive role to the test. We're hoping that this will lead to more public interest and better communication about nuclear threats in the future.
There were reports of people, especially younger people who were not familiar with the impact of the bomb, leaving the film really shaken up by it, really impacted by it, even though it was sanitized of what the actual impact was on the ground in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and certainly the aftermath with the downwinders in Trinity. What change, if anything, have you seen in the willingness of people to explore further, perhaps find ways of getting engaged and involved in this movement?
Amazingly, just 1 week after the official release of Oppenheimer, the Senate voted to expand RECA, which is the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, to include people who lived downwind of the Trinity test, which, as you know, was depicted in the Oppenheimer film. Civilians harmed by radiation from the Trinity blast have never been included in RECA, and there's really no understandable reason why. But the expansion of RECA has been attributed in part to the success. Perhaps most vocal about that opinion is Senator Ben Ray Lujan of New Mexico. He's been working on RECA expansion for years. I also think that another result of the film, which I'm kind of focusing on that, Libby, because that's where I met you, is that screening. But the panels we convened all had a common theme in that they all included representatives from communities that were impacted by the Manhattan Project, the Trinity test itself, or other nuclear weapons activities. The screening event gave us a chance to pass the mic to people whose stories have not previously been told. But then impacted communities now are getting the opportunity to tell their stories to an even broader audience now. One great example is Tina Cordova's recent article in the New York Times. So frankly, people are starting to engage. 1,300 people joined our screenings across the country, which we were worried that we wouldn't sell out any of the theaters. We were worried they wouldn't be even partially sold out. And we sold every single one out, and people sat there to listen to our partners and our experts and our community talk about this issue. So I feel like people are beginning to see past the block maybe that they had before.
This is such a learning moment or a reminder moment that when we gather, we're very powerful. And what can we do when we spend time together learning and discussing these issues? It's important to be thinking about how people get information about nuclear weapons and nuclear war. Often that is through pop culture moments like the Oppenheimer film. And then how do we harness that energy? And so I think Bonnie's example of how that energy has been harnessed in order to support impacted communities is really, really important. These moments don't happen by accident. There have been decades and decades of work by impacted communities across the U.S. and by advocacy organizations working hand in hand with impacted communities that allowed us to harness the moment that Oppenheimer brought. You know, we've had some short extensions of the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. There are limited groups of people who are still currently eligible for pieces of that compensation. But the Trinity Downwinders have never been eligible. Certain communities in Nevada, Utah, across the Mountain West, you know, Montana, the Dakotas, who were impacted by fallout, have never been eligible under that legislation. And that's just through kind of politics and oversight, different categories of uranium workers, et cetera. And really what I think the strong connections built before the Oppenheimer film are really what allowed the conversation to get to this point politically and what allowed the Senate to pass the expanded version of RECA, which, you know, we've been told for ages is just too expensive, which is ridiculous when you look at what our country spends on nuclear weapons, just maintaining our arsenal every year. And so it's really through, I think, the strong energy and campaigning of impacted communities themselves that we were able to have that win. But we need to do that work in the background and do that work day in and day out in order to harness the moments that we get from media attention like Oppenheimer.
Speaking of the media attention, I'm a member of a national media organization, and I found that the reporters there basically see me coming and they think I've got nuclear cooties because they turn and run in the other direction. They haven't wanted to discuss things. We haven't had a meeting in person since Oppenheimer's happened, so I'll be interested to see whether their orientation has changed. But there certainly has been an outpouring of articles in the media, especially dealing with downwinder issues and the land that was virtually stolen from the people who were living in the place where Los Alamos was built, and so many other aspects of the nuclear issue. It's like there's a new openness and a new investigation. What do we do to maintain that and keep feeding that cycle so that reporters don't go back to sleep?
I think continuing to use these media moments, I think that it's pretty obvious that Oppenheimer will be up for some Academy Awards, which also makes the moment salient a little bit longer than it might otherwise be. I think also, you know, we were able to harness the media environment in part because of the Hollywood strike, the strikes that are occurring. Normally, actors and directors, et cetera, would be the ones in front of the media, but we were able to really position ourselves as experts who could respond to the film. And that was really enabled by just the crazy moment that's happening in Hollywood right now. So I think really just looking for those moments and being able to refer to pop culture, even as the news is happening, right? As, you know, the war in Ukraine continues, as the U.S.-China relationship continues to be discussed in the media, as North Korea continues missile tests, et cetera, being able to kind of tie things back to what the public knows and understands, for example, the Oppenheimer film or other kind of pop culture moments, will really help the media keep their eye on the prize and also help to ensure that our language isn't only accessible to experts. You know, you do not have to be an expert to care about the impact of nuclear weapons. I think that that's a common misconception, is that, you know, in order to engage in dialogue around these policy issues, you have to understand, you know, kind of the inner workings and health impacts and, you know, have kind of a PhD in nuclear chemistry or something like that. And that just isn't the case. Anyone can care, and it's important that our policymakers hear us. So I think just using those moments and continuing to build momentum is really important.
I want to add on to Mac's comment about anyone can be an expert and just mention that I myself come from an arts background and have ended up director of development of one of the biggest organizations working on nuclear threats. So it's true. Anyone can enter this field and become more engaged in it.
And I know from personal experience here in Southern California with the Mothers Against the Santa Susana Field Lab, which, of course, is an energy and a waste set of issues, the mothers in particular are extremely powerful in getting information across. They don't need degrees in anything. All they have to say is, my child is sick. My friend's child is sick. That has more power, I think, than anything to get across to our legislators, the impact that nuclear radiation has, not only from bombs, but in the aftermath of all the manufacturing and all the waste and all the other issues that we are dealing with. Now, speaking to your background in the arts, how important do you feel it is to expand an anti-nuclear perspective in the arts, be it film, stage, television, radio, podcasting, music, all of those? How important is that?
Intrinsically bring people together. So it creates this opportunity to share an experience and share knowledge and share growth and emotion. There's just so many opportunities. We work with so many different artists and people who are using their kind of creative juices to spread this messaging. And it just is, it's always so powerful. I was in LA after the Oppenheimer screening there, and I went to the Keith Haring exhibit, and I had no idea how invested he was in nuclear issues during his life. You know, you think of the other street art that he was doing, other political focuses. So I was just so inspired. I was like, I'm starting to notice that it's coming up everywhere. It's so interesting to me. And seeing it from an artistic perspective, I think, brings a lot of joy to my heart, specifically as an artist myself, or, you know, my previous life. And I recently had a conversation with Mariah Gomez. She's an author from Santa Fe who joined us as a panelist during our Santa Fe screening of Oppenheimer. Her cousin, Yvonne Montoya, actually has created a ballet, a production called Stories from Home. And one part of that, one ballet selection from that, is called Parejito. And it is actually about her father's journey with cancer as a downwinder in Santa Fe. That's actually going to debut in Washington, D.C. in October.
Thank you for mentioning this ballet premiere in DC. I'm based in DC and I would love to go see it. Just to tack on, I think that the arts bring such a humanism to these issues. People connect with stories. And I think that that's one of the key takeaways from the Oppenheimer film that I have, as well as from working with impacted community members, lobbying alongside them in my previous role with Women's Action for New Directions, a feminist peace organization working on nuclear abolition, is really, even when we're in the room with congressional staff, it's the stories that are really moving to them, how people are impacted by the nuclear weapons complex. And exactly what you've said, Libby, about people impacted by nuclear waste, people are impacted across the country. And when they hear these stories of, you know, my child contracted cancer, that's not their fault. It's the fault of the US military industrial complex and our love for these weapons. And these weapons aren't actually keeping us safe. They're causing deep, deep harm in our communities. And whenever we're able to tell the individual stories of people impacted, it just makes our case even stronger for abolition, for compensation to those harmed by the military-industrial complex, and nuclear weapons industrial complex, and beyond.
You talked about having a platform through which groups coordinate with each other. Is this an ongoing coalition? Is this a once every so often conference? How are we being brought together so that we're using the same talking points, the same timings, and can amplify in our own echo chamber?
Aligning Action is an ongoing thing. We put it into practice for the Oppenheimer screenings, specifically on the screening events, but also I should mention that MAC used that Aligning Action platform to also coordinate our joint and collective communications about the film as the film release approached, during the process of its release, and then now as we're continuing on. So she was really critical to this the creating collective messaging that then we are continuing to push forward. And I don't think that without like her bringing our field together in that way, that we would have quite the level of impact that we have. So I just want to call out Mac for that. Other things that Aligning Action has looked at, one is response to Putin's threats, of nuclear use back in 2022. And also now looking ahead, we're looking at arms control and how we can collectively like work together to create a new future for arms control.
Let's take a step back and look at the international picture, because certainly here in the US, there's been resistance to or an ignorance of learning more about the nuclear issue until the Oppenheimer film. And hopefully that will continue to grow. But internationally, it seems that there's more awareness, certainly in Europe, of these issues. Am I seeing that correctly? And if so, what's happening to coordinate the European-based groups with what's happening here in the US?
I think that there's traditionally just been a very strong peace community in Europe. Europe tends to have, more of a soft power approach to international relations, really encouraging dialogue between states, whereas the US relies a lot on our nuclear arsenal and our nuclear umbrella in order to engage in global politics. That's something that many of us would really like to change and to shift. And it's something we can really learn from our European partners and in working hand in hand with them. And also, I think that there's just a lot of truth to the fact that they have this very proximate nuclear threat in Russia as their neighbor, particularly in Eastern Europe. Whereas the US, we are the proximate threat. We are the nuclear weapons holder in North America. And so there's just kind of an obvious difference there in kind of the relations and in how people relate to the political elites in their particular countries. So I'll just name that. And then also, there are really fantastic organizations that operate on either side of the Atlantic. And I think that there's a lot of work to be done, for example, with ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, who have operations in many countries around the world and have a very strong and engaged grassroots activist base. And I think the more that actors like us in the US can work with and learn from groups like ICAN, the stronger position we're going to be as a movement as a whole.
Of course, we now have the TPNW, the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons, which currently has 68 states parties and 27 further states have signed but not yet ratified. That means a total of 95 states, or 48% of all states, meaning countries, have accepted binding obligations in international law to prohibit nuclear weapons. How can that factor in to bringing together this international movement and perhaps raise awareness in the United States, which as a nuclear weapons holder isn't really interested in anybody saying you can't have those or don't do that? What can we do to perhaps promote an understanding of that in the general public?
I think the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is an amazing tool to organize around. I think there's a lot of opportunity if we think about who are the countries that the US listens to when it comes to international relations. And the more that we can work with groups, with grassroots in some of the countries that could become really influential signatories to the TPNW, the stronger we are in the US. For example, if some of our strong European allies sign on to the TPNW, that helps us as activists and experts and advocates in the US to make the case to the US that, this is something that even their allies are calling for and asking for, and that we need to start making these steps towards abolition and towards decreasing our nuclear arsenals alongside other countries around the world.
One of the programs that supports the TPNW is Don't Bank on the Bomb, which I think is a brilliant, little known and little understood program to help grassroots people anywhere divest from their bank accounts, move their bank accounts over somewhere else, if the bank that they are banking with is invested in any of the nuclear weapons producing corporations. What, if anything, have you done with Don't Bank on the Bomb?
That is such an incredible campaign. Thank you for raising that, Libby. We haven't formally worked with Don't Bank on the Bomb, but Coming from a background in genocide and mass atrocities prevention, I began my work in the peace movement in the Save Darfur period. I can just mention that divestment has traditionally been a very strong tool for public engagement on these issues. If we look back to the anti-apartheid movement, financial leverage was a huge part of how US-based allies were able to push for apartheid to end in South Africa. And during the era of the genocide in Darfur, which unfortunately continues to this day in various ways given the situation in Sudan, it was a way for the public to really try to hold financial institutions accountable for the harms that they were causing. So highly support efforts like this and think that this is a great resource for our communities.
So we're at this moment with Oppenheimer, with the treaty, with Don't Bank on the Bomb, with your two organizations. There is an increase in awareness of certainly nuclear weapons and the fallout from Trinity, and so many other aspects of the nuclear issue are coming to the fore in people's minds. What can individuals who are angered, upset, who want to do something, what can they do to become involved with your organizations, or what would you suggest that they do?
I would say, Libby, they're already listening to this podcast, so that's a great start. Educating yourself is number one, right? If podcasts are your thing, Plowshares Fund also has a podcast. You can add to your rotation. It's called Press the Button. That is available wherever you get your podcasts. This current season is focused on the shadow of Oppenheimer. So essentially looking at the film and telling the stories that remain untold despite the film's success. For more information on what we fund and who we fund, you can find a full list of our grantees on our website at plowshares.org. And finally, I would just say, donate your curiosity. You know, you can sign up for our emails or follow the great work again of Rethink and the daily news update that Mac mentioned earlier. And also Plowshares Funds regularly sends out information.
I'll jump in just to add that donating our money and our time are both really valuable. So donating to Plowshares is wonderful. There's also a number of groups. This is by no means a comprehensive list, but some of the groups that we work very closely with include the Union of Concerned Scientists, Physicians for Social Responsibility, Global Zero, Win Without War, Back from the Brink. They send out really helpful action alerts when there's a big voting moment in Congress, for example, or if it's an important moment to engage the executive branch or to talk to your local government. So being on those email listservs is a great place to start to get those action alerts, to take action as you're able. Starting there is really important, you know, doing those click to take actions. And then, you know, if you're compelled, you can take that next step. You can write a letter to the editor in your local newspaper. You can think about coming to Washington, D.C. or going to your local congressional office to talk to a staffer in that office about why you care about nuclear abolition issues. So there's, you know, kind of a whole spate of things that folks can do in order to get more involved. And I'd recommend checking out some of those organizations in order to get started.
You will both send me the necessary links so that I can post them on the website with this interview so that people can pick their place for taking the next step into an activist response. One final question, and this is the rude question. In your most pessimistic moments, how screwed are we?
I'm going to come at this from a fundraising perspective. While we are a grant maker, we also raise all the money that we give out in grants throughout the year. There are a lot of funders pulling out of this work. Specifically, MacArthur Foundation has recently left the nuclear field. They did take their time and their wind down. And so that was, you know, a thoughtful way to do it. But it has left a deficit of about $20 million per year. Our adversaries have way more money than our field has. So I would say from a funding perspective, things are looking a little bit bleak, and that is taking its toll on our partners, specifically just having the capacity, having the resources to do the necessary work. So Plowshares Fund, again, is taking this supportive role. We're trying to build back some of those funds so that we can be the organization that puts them out into the field. It's tough. So I would say that's what makes me the most nervous about this. that people are not investing in this work at this time, at this really critical moment. I mean, we see what's happening in Ukraine, and it's tough to do that without the resources and the people power to get the messaging out.
Yes, I think that's a huge point, is that, you know, we're talking pennies when the military industrial complex has billions of dollars to spend on these issues. I would say also that from a comms standpoint, we are living in an oversaturated media environment. We're living in an environment where even the really large, well-funded publications are cutting their foreign bureaus. We're seeing local journalism fall by the wayside just in terms of where funding is able to go. We're seeing media conglomerates popping up, and that really changes the way that the public is able to engage on these issues from wherever they are in the country or the world. And we're also living in this environment where there are a ton of issues that are grabbing the public's attention. I mean, look at the devastation wrought by climate change. Look at the wildfires happening in Maui right now in Hawaii. There's a lot that the public is afraid of and that they want their policymakers to tackle. And we're kind of in a David and Goliath situation where we're going up against these really difficult forces. I draw hope from a lot of the young people that I see in the field, bringing in perspectives from other movements, you know, from racial justice movements, from the climate movement, from movements against police brutality or gun violence prevention. There's a lot of new perspectives to be had and a lot of connections to be made between these issues. And we're all kind of fighting against the same forces. And so maybe I'll leave us on that note of hope that we're up against really difficult forces, but also it's people power that's won almost every battle that we've had as a society, and we have to keep fighting together.
I always like to remind people that in a David and Goliath battle, David won.
Exactly.
Bonnie Fisk and Mack Hamilton, this has been an amazing, eye-opening, joyous interview for me to talk with two women who are so knowledgeable, who are so entrenched in doing the work, and who are so powerful in what it is that you are moving forward. And I want to thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Libby.
That was Bonnie Fisk of the Plowshares Fund, and Mack Hamilton, Program Director, Peace and Security for Rethink Media. We will have links up to both groups, and especially one where you can sign up for Rethink's daily summary of nuclear stories that have been in the news. It's an amazing resource. All of this will be on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 635. And considering that we brought up the subject of Don't Bank on the Bomb, here is a brief explanation of it by Susie Snyder, who now is with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, but back when we spoke, she was the head and the voice of Don't Bank on the Bomb. We spoke at Dr. Helen Caldicott's Symposium on Possible Nuclear Extinction on February 28, 2015.
It's amazing. It's called Don't Bank on the Bomb. And that's the website, too, don'tbankonthebomb.com. Step one, find out if your bank invests in nuclear weapon producers. Step two, contact your bank. Tell them you don't want them to. Step three, tell the world what the bank says. And if they don't get rid of investments, go public. Because no bank wants to look like a bad guy. It takes one or two people only to make a huge difference. And that can cut off the money stream to the companies that make nuclear weapons. You and I, we have more power than we think, and that power is sitting in our wallet.
And how can people find out whether the companies that we're told the bank is supporting have any connection with the nuclear weapons industry?
Well, we do a significant investigation every year. Now, it's not completely exhaustive, but we profile 28 companies that have association with nuclear weapons modernization and maintenance. And it's on our website, don'tbankonthebomb.com. And we really want people to use our information and contact us all the time. You can do that in, you know, through the website really easily. Contact me on Twitter, whatever works. And I'm happy to find out more. And if you find out, learn about more companies involved in nuclear weapons, tell us. We'll do the research and we'll make it public for everybody to use.
Love it.
I loved it when I first heard about it, and I love it still. We have a longer interview with Susie about the program and its implications and the progress it has been making. It's up on Nuclear Hot Seat number 454 from March 3rd, 2020. Check it out on our website. That's where we'll also have a link to Don't Bank on the Bomb.
Activists, shout out.
There are demonstrations taking place literally around the world against Japan's dumping of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean. We have a comprehensive list that has been compiled by Denise Yoon of the Korean Center for Sustainable Development, and we will have a link to it posted on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 635. You're also free to come up with an action of your own. I personally have not eaten sushi since the Fukushima disaster began on March 11 of 2011, but if you have been eating it, you might want to join the move to boycott sushi and show up at your local restaurant and explain to them exactly why you are not going to be eating sushi. It's a small gesture, not a lot of money represented by each one of us, but the only thing that has ever turned around issues like this is some kind of economic pressure. And this is one that is not only within your power to take, but has the potential to make the news and possibly put some pressure on Japan. One never knows, but we must try everything that we possibly can. And I am returning to my big honking ask. It's something that's easy to implement if you have a website that covers nuclear, environmental, or climate change issues. And that is to please include a posted permanent link to Nuclear Hot Seat. I can provide you with a visual, I can provide you with an RSS feed, anything that is needed. But the only way this show gets out is by communicating with each other. So taking a tip from Rethink Media, I'm asking, and I hope you can help me out. You can always send a message to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and I'll be happy to provide you with all the necessary materials. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, August 22nd, 2023. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat every week without fail, you can sign up for it on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase and we'll do the work for you. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. The yellow box will pop up. Put in your first name and an email address, and that way, every week, you will get one email, I don't bug you, one email with the link and a short description of the show's content. That way you need never miss a single episode that follows what's going on in our ever more nuclear saturated world. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com with that information. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all will support us, and we will always appreciate it. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2023, Libby Halevi, Nuclear Hot Seat and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, the name of the guest whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that there are not 7 separate oceans on planet Earth. There is one body of water with 7 basins that are all connected. What happens to one ultimately happens to all the others, including the spread of tritium-contaminated radioactive water from the Pacific to everywhere else. So if you think you're immune to the consequences of this Fukushima radioactive water dump, you're not. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.